Our subject is quietness. And our text is found in Isaiah, the 32nd chapter, verses 17 and 18. Isaiah 32. And the work of righteousness shall be peace. And that's true. Wherever there is a high degree of righteousness, and wherever righteousness is being exercised, to that extent, the people are blessed. The wise man observed that when the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. And when the wicked beareth the rule, the people mourn. And isn't that true, according to the events of history? Wherever we have found righteousness, even in government, to a small degree, to that extent, the people rejoice and are happy. But whenever the wicked beareth the rule, immediately it's a cause for mourning. Well, maybe we need to say a word for quietness. Maybe the world is noisy because they like noise. From the good business that they're doing in portable TVs and portable radios and phonographs, it's apparent that the people in the world, they're not so anxious for quietude. They like noise. They like sounds. They like to have their mind filled with different things. But quietness, they're not much for that. But before we pass quietness off or silence off as being of little worth, let's just remember that really around all the great issues of life, there is quietness. We know that the surest search is made in silence. Moses learned more in the 40 years of tending sheep, working as a shepherd, than he did in the previous 40 years in the courts of Pharaoh. We know that David got his start in the lonely valleys herding sheep. And we know that Jesus, when he began his ministry, he sought the Lord in 40 days of prayer, meditation, and fasting. And Paul, when he started his ministry, he went to Arabia. And there he found his quietness to find and to prepare himself for the ministry which was to follow. And so we see that they found in these secluded spots what might otherwise have eluded them in the busy haunts of men. Then we know that silence reaches beyond words. Very often the highest point, the tensest moment in a drama is the point of silence. We know that the most valid emotions do not necessarily cry aloud. We know that the most effective reproof is not necessarily a tongue lashing. Remember when Jesus just looked at Peter. That was a sufficient reproof to him. Why, Peter went out weeping immediately. The most pointed grief is not expressed in wild shrieking and so on. No. And we know that the sincerest sympathy does not need to be talkative. We know that the deepest love is not noisy. And we also know that the finest comradeship does not need many words. The best answer to an ill-tempered letter? You know what it is. It's just silence. The best preparation in an emergency very often is just quietness. Matter of fact, in the British Navy, I don't know if it's still true, but it used to be whenever a disaster occurred, it was the bugler's duty to sound the still. And every man's duty was to remain still for a moment, collecting his thoughts in preparation for intelligent action. Then we know, too, that the best proof of greatness is silence. The great engine, for instance, is almost noiseless. If you've ever listened to a Cadillac go down the street, it just whisper. Whereas some of the cheaper models and the worn models, we know they're just rattle traps. The success story, that too, usually is very short. In the parable of the talents, the successful man made his report in 14 words. The unsuccessful man gave his unsuccessful story in 42 words. The man with the writer's ink cord took only 8 words to sum up his story. He said, "I have done as thou hast commanded me." And Jesus, when he rendered his final report, he only needed 3 words. He says, "It is finished." Now, quietness, like many other things, is a good thing for the Lord's people, but at the other hand, it can be overdone. Maybe Satan realized that it had its merits for the Lord's people, it had its benefits for the Lord's people, and he invaded this field too. And so we find these mystics and sometimes people in the Christian church who carry this matter of quietness to great extremes. We find some in the churches who are sworn to perpetual quietness. Some of them have never spoken a word in 20 or 30 years. We know that that is the mystics' approach to devotion to the Lord. They feel that it is in quietness and seclusion and meditation, and they carry it to ridiculous extremes. One Christian mystic, if there is such a thing, defined perfect prayer as being the state of quietude in which there should be absolutely no thought or wish or hope. Vocal prayer, confession, and all external things, he said, are but hindrances. Well, we shudder at such a condition of mind where the mind is enforced into a stupor and it has no wish, no hope, no desire. That is his concept of the ultimate development, but we see in this nothing to be desired. It's not an approach to the intelligent mind, to the intelligent heart. Actually, our approach to our Creator was supposed to be one of reason. Come, let us reason together. While we're not overlooking the emotional aspect, we realize that actually they go together, that reason and devotion to the Lord can go hand in hand. And on this matter, I just happened to check into Madame Guyon's beliefs. I know Brother Russell quoted from her, and some of the friends felt very near to her because she did say some nice things, some beautiful sentiments were expressed from her pen. But when we study what her real concept was, it isn't quite as beautiful as some of her writings are. She believed, according to Strong and McClintock, that she had learned a method by which souls might be carried to such a state of perfection that the continual act of contemplation and love may be substituted for all other acts of religion. Now imagine, she had carried this idea of meditation and contemplation of the Lord's beauty and his character and so on to such a degree that she felt that that would replace all other acts of religion. The old standard of self-sacrifice and self-denial, the labor that Brother Sumbaum was speaking of, in which the saints are engaged at the present time, why, she omits all of this, and she substitutes rather an act of continual contemplation of the Lord. Well, there's nothing in this that brings light. What is there in her teaching that the mind, that reason, can receive? Bringing no light, she apparently makes darkness an excellent and holy thing. And to me, I just shudder at any concept of religion in which the mind cannot enter into as well as the heart. They go together. Now, in treating this matter of quietness, I want to make it clear that I'm not saying that quietness is a virtue. It is not. Actually, it is only an atmosphere that is helpful to true virtue. It's an attitude, really, in which the mind is prepared for accomplishment. Now, in this matter of quietness, we divide it really into two aspects. First, from the standpoint of an inward rest and peace based on abiding and unshakable confidence in God and the ultimate reward for righteousness. And then the second part, a quietude with regard to speech and utterance, that is, a time in which superficiality is avoided. In both respects, as new creatures in Christ Jesus, we are to have and enjoy this quietness. Now, we know that quietness inheres in God. Brother Russell said that God's is a mind tranquil and calm, undisturbed. It's never agitated or weary or perplexed by any cares of his vast dominion. He is never confused, bewildered, perplexed, anxious, or careworn, nor in the least fearful that his plans will miscarry or his purposes fail, because all power and wisdom inhere in him, because the scope of his mighty intellect reaches to the utmost bounds of possibility, comprehends all causes, discerns all effects. Consequently, he knows the end from the beginning, and that not only upon philosophical principles, but also by intuition. As the creator of all things and the originator of all law, he is thoroughly acquainted with all the intricate subtleties of physical, moral, and intellectual law, so that no problem could arise the results of which are not manifest to him. God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. From his own vast inherent resources of power, wisdom, and knowledge, he is able to be at rest and to have quietness, because he is equal to whatever may come in the universe. But not only from these sources alone does he possess quietness and peace. No, our text says that the work of righteousness shall be peace, and the effect of righteousness, quietness, and assurance forever. And in that God is the source and impersonation of every virtue and every grace, he has the blessed satisfaction of peace and quietness forever. Yes, his quietness is founded on the unshakable pillars of justice, wisdom, and power. And typical of his inward quietness, why, we see the whole universe with maybe a trillion galaxies around him, yet there is no voice, there is no sound that they make that is audible to us. And yet their words, as the psalmist says, goes forth into the whole world. And we can observe many lessons just by looking into the heavens concerning the peace and the quietude of our Creator. And it was God's intention that we, his human creatures, should enjoy peace and quietude that he enjoys. And a man originally did enjoy that in the Garden of Eden. Eden was a quiet, restful, holy place. But as soon as sin entered, why, that all changed. From that day until now, there has been confusion, strife, and war, and commotion. And while men now claim more progress and more education than ever before, there never was so much double talk, so many empty promises, so great unrest, so much trouble. The world is just echoing and re-echoing with threats and demands and the thundering clamor of many voices and people that are demanding their rights. Everywhere we turn, there is noise and confusion and unrest, disquietude. And one basic reason underlies it all. If we were to use one word, we would just say sin. That's at the root of the whole matter. And we know that there will be no quietude in the world until the world is prepared to receive righteousness at the hands of the Lord. Remember in Elijah's vision where he was taken up to Mount Horeb, which was the Mount of God. And while in that mount, the Lord commanded, and he says, "Go forth and stand upon the mount before the Lord." And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and a strong wind rent the mountain and brake in pieces the rocks before the Lord. Notice what the text says then. It says why the Lord wasn't in the wind. And then following this, There was a great earthquake that rent the mountain, shaking the rocks loose, no doubt, and creating a great sound as the turmoil of those rocks and the shaking earth took place. But the Lord wasn't in the earthquake. And then following this, a fire covered the mountain. But the Lord wasn't in the fire. And then following this, there was a still small voice. And that expression, a still small voice, in the Hebrew is better translated, a sound of gentle stillness. And then it was that the Lord spoke. Then it was that the Lord was in that gentle stillness. Now there's where the Lord could be found. And this is paralleled in the 46th Psalm. Remember how that the Lord makes wars to cease unto the ends of the earth. And then he speaks. And when does he speak? Oh, he says, be still. At the time in which the nations began to be quiet, then they are prepared to hear the voice of the Lord. That's the first thing he commands. Be still and know that I am God. And then he says at the same time, be silent, O all flesh, before the Lord. That's the first thing that he's going to command, is silence. For he is raised up out of his holy habitation. Well, we know that in the kingdom that the Lord will bring about quiet conditions. But what we're interested in now at the present time is the quietness that belongs to you and me, the people of God, at this time. And we need quietness not as a virtue, but as a reward of righteousness, as a condition favorable to growth in grace. Now we know that our quietness is not going to be an outward one. It may for a while be that when we enter this narrow way, as has been brought out, that the Lord will give us a quiet season. He'll cause the sun to shine, and he'll cause many blessings to come our way, and everything will be quiet and tranquil in our lives for a season. But it will not continue long, because sooner or later, the Lord in his providence is going to see to it that we receive our share of trials, disappointments, discouragements, misunderstandings, and so on. And failure to understand the ministry of sorrow in our experiences sometimes may cause a great deal of anxiety. Even if we have faith sometimes and we lack understanding, it may put us at a great disadvantage in receiving our trials. We know that this particular matter was true in Job's experience. Job was a man that had faith. He was a righteous man, and yet because he did not understand the ministry of evil, the permission of evil in his experience, Job was disquieted. We know that he enjoyed comparative peace and tranquility in his experience. Then it was all taken from him suddenly, and he found himself in great sorrow and distress. And then later in the Lord's providence, it was all returned to him, the quietness and peace that he had. What kind of a man was Job? Have you ever wondered about that? Well, according to the account that we're given, Job was just a towering example among men. He was a man that, according to the account given in Job, that why you would love him as soon as you made his acquaintance. He was just a towering pillar among men whom you could look up to. Why, when he would go through the streets, the record is that the old men would rise up when he came, and the young men would step out of his way. The princes, those that were in authority at that time, well, they would be silent when he came by. And when you heard him speak, the record indicates that you would bless him, and you would witness to his goodness. He was a type of man that would deliver the poor and the fatherless and the one who is helpless. The record indicates that he caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. He was eyes to the blind. He was feet to the lame. He was a father to the poor. And the cause which he knew not, why, what did he do? Just disregard it? When somebody came to him with a complaint, did he say, well, that's all right, suffer a while, it'll pass, it'll be all right? No, Job was not that kind of man. The cause that he didn't know, if someone came to him with a complaint, That was his responsibility. The record says he searched it out. He made investigation to see to it that justice, that righteousness would come to that individual. The record indicates that he never despised the cause of his maidservant or his manservant when they contended with him. Even when they came to him with grief, with complaints and grievances, he never despised them. He would listen to their complaint and their grievance, and he would try to deal justly with them. He never withheld from the poor their desire. And he never allowed the widow to look in vain for help. And were any hungry around Job? The record indicates that before Job would sit down to supper meal, he would inquire, "Is anyone hungry? Are there any of the widow's children that are hungry?" And if he heard that there were, he would not eat supper until those children were fetched and brought not to his house, but to his table. And they would sit down and eat with him. He wouldn't eat if anyone else was hungry that he knew of. And if there was anyone in need of clothing that came to Job's attention, why, they were clothed with the fleece from his sheep. Never did the stranger have to lodge in the street at night, because his doors were always open to them. You see what a towering man Job was. He was a likeness, a picture of man in his perfection. And when you read the account, you can see a little bit what perfect man would be like. And yet, the Lord allowed him to suffer disquietude. And of course, his comforters came to him, and because they didn't understand why God was permitting this disquietude in his life, they made false and foolish charges. And three of the aged men that had come first to comfort him have all uttered their words of comfort, their foolish charges, really what it amounted to. But there was a fourth party, a younger man by the name of Elihu, who had sat there with the three and with Job, taking all their conversation in. Being the youngest, he didn't want to say anything. He thought that these older men would come forth with some words of wisdom. And he listened intently as one and the other spoke. And he was becoming more incensed as the conversation went on. Until finally, Elihu, when the third comforter had finished his piece, he couldn't hold himself anymore. He very angrily interrupted. And he was angry with the three men because they had imputed evil to Job. And he was angry, too, with Job because he justified himself more than he justified God. And then Elihu made this statement, a very beautiful one, not inspired, but still it expresses a great deal of wisdom. He said, "When he giveth quietness, who then can make trouble? And when he hideth his face, who then can behold him?" This was Elihu's defense of God and his justification of Job. He knew that Job was a righteous man. He could see nothing in Job's conduct or life that merited any suspicion on his part. And yet he knew that God apparently wasn't giving Job quietness. There must be some reason. He couldn't give the reason. But he knew this, that God was not giving Job quietness, and that was in his hands. However he wanted to deal was his business. And we see that this expresses a great truism. While he didn't quite explain the ministry of evil, he couldn't put his finger on it, not knowing what we know in the plan of God, he came very close to it. And as a result, we know that Elihu was not among those who was reproved of God. The other three comforters, why, Job had to offer words of intercession on their behalf, but Elihu was not reproved with the others. Now, we are given the understanding that some of these righteous men of the past did not possess. We know what Job didn't know, that the Lord allows affliction for our development, for our testing, for our trial and preparation, when we shall inherit the glory with the saints in life. We know that trials, that disciplines are necessary for our preparation. We know, and we've been schooled in the thought, that the cross must precede the crown. We are taught right from the start that it's only if we be dead with him that we shall live with him. And we know that, as Paul says, that all things work together for good to those that love God, to those that are called according to his purpose. We know all of this. And if we know it, then why does Peter say, "Think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing had happened unto you"? Well, this reminds me a little bit of sometimes when the younger brethren are preparing to give their first discourse before the church. I'm sure in every ecclesia we've had occasions like this where brethren have come along in the truth, and finally the day comes in which the church wants to give them a talk or an opportunity to address them in a symposium or some sort of service. And these brethren are told about their privilege of service, and so they go to work and they prepare the sermon. And they work feverishly. Some of them put in double the effort that the elders sometimes put in on a talk. They spend many hours and nights gathering their material and putting it all together. They know just what they're going to say, and they know just what part in their discourse they want to emphasize. They have it all down very well because this is their first discourse. And then the moment comes in which they're brought before the congregation, and the chairman introduces them, and suddenly they find themselves standing before a large audience, and everyone staring at them, waiting for him to speak. And, you know, a strange feeling comes over that party, and that's the only thing that he hasn't prepared for in his notes. He had everything else prepared, but that strange feeling, that helpless feeling in this predicament. And usually that strange feeling affects the otherwise flawless discourse. It will cause him to stumble over parts that he had in mind very well. Well, I think sometimes it's that way in our Christian experience. We prepare our hearts and our minds for the trials, but when they come, oh, it's that strangeness, that peculiar feeling when we find ourselves in these trying circumstances. And as the fears and doubts assail, the natural impulses would almost cause us to cry out in alarm. But then is the time for remembering that this is not strange. Why, even hereunto where we call. This is a part of our experience. Yes, we may know all the various promises of the Scriptures. That doesn't mean that we won't have the strange feeling. We may have all these things in our minds. We might have been able to quote a dozen, 20, or even more of the precious promises that we would normally think would sustain us in the trial. But unless, in this trial or experience that we're going through, unless we collect ourselves quietly and go over the promises, why, those promises will do us little good. And so it is written, "In returning and in rest shall ye be saved. In quietness and in confidence shall be your strength." How true this is. There are many examples in the Scriptures of those who would not return and have rest and confidence in the Lord. We see that the Israelites were a good illustration of this. They would not rest in the Lord. They would not have confidence in the Lord for any length of time. Only spasmodically they would exercise a little confidence, but they wouldn't return. They wouldn't continue to have that quietness, that abiding confidence that would continue with them day after day. We know that when they left Egypt, they came to the Red Sea, and there, in that peculiar situation, they found the Red Sea lapping at their feet, and they found Pharaoh's army pursuing right behind them. And all they could see was that Red Sea, coming in at them, and all they could see is the dust behind from Pharaoh's army. But you know, there was a whole lot more to see than that. If they had just looked around, they would have seen why the cloud, the pillar of cloud was still there by day, and the pillar of fire was still there by night. But they didn't see that somehow. All they could see was the Red Sea and the pursuing army of the Pharaoh. And how is it in our trial? What do we see? Do we just see the Red Sea on the one side and Pharaoh's army coming in on the other side? Or do we pause and look around and look at the cloud there by day, a symbol of the Lord's abiding faithfulness, that he is directing us in this experience, and the pillar of fire by night? Oh, that puts the trial in a whole lot different category. Well, after that deliverance, somehow they could see the cloud again, and they could see the pillar of fire again, and they were jubilant, and they were singing unto the Lord for the deliverance that he had brought them. So from there they went into the wilderness of Shur. And after one day's journey, they didn't find any water. And 2 days' journey, they didn't find any water. And then the third day, and still no water. Finally, they came to Marah. They found water, but it was bitter, and so were they. Yes, they were bitter. They said, "What shall we drink?" They didn't have confidence. Now, it wasn't that they actually hadn't had a drink in 3 or 4 days of water. That isn't the thought. Now, they apparently kept a good supply of water with them. But they were becoming anxious over their water supply. And the third day, they thought surely they'd come to water, and they didn't find any, and then they came finally to some water. Their supplies were probably just about this time diminished, and they were anxious, and they were bitter. Now, what are we going to drink? See, actually, sometimes we read this, we think that they were 3 days without water. Well, in that arid wilderness, we could understand why 3 days without water, they'd practically be dead. But they had a little water during those 3 days, and it was just that their lack of confidence in the Lord. What will we drink? Because they didn't see any tangible water around. And so, dear friends, as we travel through this wilderness, are we going to ask, what shall we drink? Then they came to the wilderness of Sin. And looking around, you know, they had been promised the land that would be flowing with milk and honey, and they had envisioned in their minds as they left Egypt that they would see beautiful trees and fruit trees and berries and everything, and they found themselves in the wilderness of Sin. There was no grain, no berries, no wildlife, and they were getting a little bit hungry. They weren't starved yet, but they were getting to the point where they were looking for a little extra food supply. And all they saw was the barren, howling wilderness. And all they could remember then at that time was the flesh pots of Egypt. Oh, those were good days back there in Egypt. We had all we wanted to eat. It was good back there in Egypt. Why did we ever leave? Well, they forgot how they were crying and sighing in that bondage, how they were really their hearts ached them to get deliverance from there. But all they could remember was the good food. And here they couldn't exercise a little confidence in the Lord, that he would supply them with food. Oh, dear friends, how necessary in all our experience that we exercise that continuing quietness and confidence through all of our experiences, not just some of them. Then we come to the second part, quietness in respect to our conversation. Now, we know that Jesus was a beautiful example of this. He had a meek and quiet spirit, which is of great price in the sight of the Lord. Of him, it is recorded that he never lifted up his voice nor cried aloud in the streets. There never was any such record of his conduct. Jesus is not known for his much speaking, for his lengthy sermons, but rather for the grace that came forth from his lips. He could have spoken on many things. After all, he was a perfect man. His mind was so far superior to others. And no doubt there were some recollections of his past after the Spirit was given him. He could have given to man a world of knowledge among all lines, and yet Jesus didn't have much to say along any of these lines. The only thing that he had to say in his whole ministry, the words that the Father had given him, why, those were the words that he spoke, no less and no more. And better, therefore, that our words be fewer and richer. You know, sometimes I think that some of our conversation tends to be, like milk. A certain percentage of it is cream, and then after you get down little ways, why, it becomes skimmed milk. And so we want to share not the skimmed milk with others, but the cream of our thoughts with others. And we should make an effort to do this. And then there's a quietness that reaches into our prayer life. Jesus said, "When ye pray, use not vain repetitions, as the heathen do, for they think that they shall be heard for their much speaking. But be ye not therefore like unto them, for your Father knoweth what things ye have need of." Now, actually, we know that sometimes in prayer there are times when words fail us. The apostle found this true in his experience. In Romans 8th chapter, verses 23 and 26, he says, "But ourselves also, which have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting for the adoption, to wit, the deliverance of our bodies." And then he says, "Likewise the Spirit," that is, our spirits, "helpeth our infirmity. For we know that we know not what we should pray for as we ought, for the Spirit itself," that is, our spirit, "the Spirit itself maketh intercession for us with groanings that cannot be uttered." We know that it isn't the Holy Spirit that's groaning in a way that can't be uttered, but it's our spirits. How often in our prayers we find ourselves just not knowing what to say. There is that quiet groaning of our hearts. We're burdened. We don't know how to pray as we ought. And yet the Lord, who is able to read the Spirit, the mind of the Spirit, of our hearts, why, he answers us not according to our groanings, but according to his knowledge of our needs. Now, in conclusion, we have considered the effect of righteousness. Our opening text spoke of the work of righteousness shall be peace, and the effect of righteousness and quietness, assurance forever. And while this promise belongs in the age to come, it expresses a principle upon which we, the Lord's people, may enjoy a rest and quietude of mind. Then we considered also the part that understanding plays in quietness. We need understanding to have quietness under the test. And finally, quietness of speech, the absence of unnecessary, carefree, and undisciplined remarks. In all of these respects, we need and should possess quietness. And now is the day when will be revealed the discipline, the principles, the loves that have ruled in your heart and in mine. We cannot bring quietness to the world at this time. We cannot bring quietness to the churches. We cannot bring quietness to the nations. We cannot bring quietness even to our own ecclesias. We cannot bring quietness to the elements that surround us, our homes and our businesses. And still, there is quietness. Quietness for you. Quietness now, quietness forever, for it is the portion of those who dwell under the shadow of the Almighty.
Thank you, Brother Burns. Surely, as has been said, when he giveth quietness, who can make trouble? Underneath his everlasting arms of strength. Source comes from on high. Now we'll close this assertion by the use of hymn number 137. But I want to bring to your attention, brethren, before we do that, some more. Call your attention to the fact that there will be a children's meeting today. The time is 1:30 after lunch. Place room 3 upstairs. Brother Julius Bednar will speak to the children ages 9 to 15 years on what it means to be a Christian. And there will be a separate session at the same time for children from 5 to 8 years old. They'll just call that, bring that to your attention. So we'll close by the use of hymn 137.
Oh.